Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We begin every show with the words of Colonel Vindman. We will do that between now and November of 2020. So as you go into the voting booth, I want you to remember Vindman and, frankly, remember Wisconsin. Stick around, Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, Monday, rethink the week. We have three great talkers joining us to talk about all the issues and chaos going on in the world and obviously in the country. Joining us is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. Joining us is Val Endres. She is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College and relatively new, but not necessarily new to the program, but new to the Rethink the Week is Paul Peter Jessup. He is a former Republican. Is that how I describe you? Worked for Susan Collins, was very active in the Republican Party in Portsmouth, and has now said au revoir because the Republican Party is a party you no longer recognize. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
And well, I don't recognize Susan Collins anymore either.
Well, there you go. Anyway, he's also an attorney. So this has been, again, one more challenging week on top of another challenging week. But I think the thing that was the most maybe depressing this week has been what we've been seeing going on in Michigan and a number of states around the country, where there are a number of protesters that are coming out with their guns, not wearing masks, not socially distancing, challenging the whole idea of isolation, of staying in place, of not opening businesses, threatening to sue, threatening to do all kinds of things. And what has been very interesting is that, Dean, I'm gonna start with you, is that President Trump has basically decided to notice when these kinds of organizations happen in democratically controlled states, controlled by Democratic governors, where he doesn't notice when it's happening with Republican governors. All right, so Dean Spiliotis, Donald Trump basically, looks at the governors who are being challenged by these groups. And when it's a Democratic governor, he basically is supporting the protesters. He's telling the governors, maybe you should negotiate with them. He's talking about that there are some good people in that crowd. But then when it happens, for example, in my state, the state of New Hampshire, where we had a couple of, 100 or so people doing it in Concord, there's no comment out of the president. So when you see the same kind of protest happening, it tends to be partisan specific when the president notices. But what are we doing with this crowd? The fact that there are 100 protesters doesn't mean that there are 10% of the population or 15% of the population that support them. There have always been a disgruntled group of kind of quasi-libertarians, NRA types that will always want an excuse to come out with their guns. But for whatever reason, we seem to be elevating this protest, even as the vast majority of Americans are willing to listen to their governors, work with their governors, and frankly are concerned about going back to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is true that the protests in the states that are controlled by Democrats, that relatively speaking, compared to the ones in Republican states, they have been a little bit larger. They have been a little bit more conflictual, not surprisingly. But if you look at the people who are out protesting in general, I don't want to overgeneralize, but nonetheless, you get a kind of a sense of the kinds of people who are out there protesting. It really kind of is a catch-all for the kinds of people who have had longstanding grievances against the federal government, against what they believe is a ruling financial class, a deep state in the federal government that's in cahoots with this this financial class. And, you know, they found a political spokesperson in Donald Trump, and Trump has very cynically and instrumentally exploited these folks for political support. They really are the core of his base, that, you know, whatever it is, 20, 25, 30% maybe of the electorate. And so he's being very careful to tend those bases. And for a variety of reasons, there are some states in the South where you are seeing smaller demonstrations against Republican governors. But from a strategic perspective, Trump realizes that it makes more sense for him to stoke the flames in states where it's going to, and some of those are important swing states like, you know, Michigan, for the presidential race in the fall. So, you know, this is all kind of very instrumental on his part, and he just kind of instinctively gravitates towards poking and prodding these kinds of situations he believes to his benefit. He believes that if these folks are up in arms, and if they're protesting, and if they're causing problems for Democratic governors, it's all in some way or another, it'll stoke turnout in November, and that will ultimately be to his benefit. And maybe if, you know, urban Democrats are sufficiently scared or concerned, you know, if they, there are, you know, there have been some kind of racial undertones to this, you know, maybe they'll stay home. So Val,
let me just read you the headline from BuzzFlash. Heroic and fearless Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer ignores Trump's advice to negotiate with armed terrorists and extends Michigan's state of emergency. I mean, it's one thing to protest. I get it. But that's not what this is. This is really, I mean, this is intentional intimidation. They're armed, like somehow that enhances their voice. And I'll be honest with you, it might be his base. But if I was a suburban housewife or I was a suburban anything, I would look at these armed terrorists and think, I don't want to embrace them any way, shape, or form. And this is not going to encourage me to continue to support Trump. In fact, it's going to terrify me about what kind of intimidation is going on, as you want to keep your family safe, you want to keep your children safe, you want to keep your community safe. And they're looking at them, and it's not even just protest, it's protest with weapons.
Absolutely. But I think the weapons are intentional, and we have to look at how the media is covering this kind of protest as opposed to, for example, in the state of Rhode Island a year ago, 200 to 300 progressives went to the state house to protest that the lack of gun control bills. And that was barely covered in even the Rhode Island media. Yeah. But yet you get a handful of people in Michigan with arms, and what it does, and media, it's great pictures. It's intimidating. The media knows that people will pay attention. And what it does is frame a narrative that says that there's a significant portion of the people out there who are in support of Donald Trump opening up the businesses and small businesses against those Democratic governors, where we know, for example, that the polls say that very large majority believe in the shutdown. And so I think in some ways the media has to accept responsibility for how they go about covering these kinds of protests.
Exactly. Could I just take Val's point one step further? And that is, what would the media or Donald Trump say if the people in Ferguson, Missouri a few years ago were carrying arms? I mean, the fact that they're carrying That's arms right. doesn't make their voice more important or their doesn't legitimize their sense of being wronged.
Well, no.
But white males get to carry arms into state houses.
Exactly.
Well, and Paul Peter. So I'm looking at this article. I mean, another article that came out said America's white terrorist problem. White supremacists have plotted the end of America as we know it and see the pandemic as their chance. And one of the paragraphs I'm going to just pull out is: we have in the United States of America a massive problem with white terrorism. Though the events of September 11th and its tragic aftermath have obfuscated the reality of our situation, white terrorism has been a much larger and more prevalent threat than anything originating from Al-Qaeda, ISIS, or any other group. White terrorists have killed more and have been involved in more incidents. It just so happens that the media refuses to connect the line between these moments and instead chooses to label them as lone killers or lone wolves. And what Val was just saying about what happened in Rhode Island, so you have a protest about gun control, but of course when you have a protest about gun control, you're carrying signs, not weapons. When you're a white supremacist, or you're a terrorist, or you're wanting this go back to work, but you do it with arms, everything changes, and then the media notices, Paul Peter.
This is about a militant minority. They are not heroes. Their rights are not being taken away. They're being inconvenienced. That's what this is about. They're being inconvenienced. They are fomenting chaos. They're fomenting bullying. And I know we're not supposed to make these parallels, but there are parallels to be made. You go back to March of 1933, there was someone in Germany who was elected chancellor, elected by a minority vote that gave him enough to take over as chancellor. I believe he received about 34% of the vote. Right. And this person did it through chaos, through bullying, and Donald Trump cannot be reelected without chaos and bullying, and shame on every freaking Republican who thinks he or she is a patriotic American who is not condemning this president's conduct. Let me quote former President George W. Bush, because he kind of capsulized it very nicely, and people like Susan Collins, who's no Margaret Chase Smith, needs to take notice. Remember, said former President Bush, how small our differences are. We are not partisan combatants. We are human beings, equally vulnerable and equally wonderful in the sight of God. We rise or fall together, and we are determined to rise. Where is Susan Collins? Where is Mitch McConnell? Where are the rest of these Republicans who call themselves patriotic Americans?
Well, but Dean, as I'm listening to what Paul Peter says, then you've got the situation where there are a number of Republican governors, Mitch McConnell is part of it in some ways, is that they all want to open up. And then the question then becomes, who is considered an essential worker? So what do we know about essential workers? Well, it turns out that people in the meatpacking industry, people in the food industry, they're essential workers. And what does Mitch McConnell want to do? Not only does he want to open up, not only does President Trump want to open up, but then they want to limit the liability of corporations, Dean. And therefore, if they open up and they don't provide the kind of safety and security and distancing and PPEs, then by limiting that liability, yeah, they're sacrificing that workforce. I mean, that's exactly, I mean, I'm looking at these guys with their weapons, and then I'm looking, and in a lot of ways, employers don't have weapons, but you know what they have? They don't have the protections that people need in order to work in a safe environment.
Yeah, I will say, Arnie, just to not to get too far off topic, but I've just had last night a long conversation about this with a friend of mine, and we were talking about this issue of liability, and we were both discussing that this issue of liability as we reopen society, I think, is going to be one of the central legal, financial, and moral issues of the next year. We were talking, the whole, you know, meatpacking. But not just meatpacking. We were talking about, you know, are all our kids going to go back to college? And if so, if they get sick in a dormitory or in a cafeteria, or is the college or university liable? I mean, senior citizen homes, rehab facilities are all now clamoring for liability protection. Every major institution in this country, we're going to have a discussion about liability. I don't know where it's going to end up. But I think we're just seeing the beginnings of this issue in virtually every facet of our lives.
Okay.
Ultimately, if we open up, who's liable? The institutions, the corporations, the government, the governor, the president? I don't have the answer, but that's going to be one of the big discussions going forward, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so Val, I'm looking at this article, and it says, over the past few days, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and key figures in the Trump White House have begun beating the drum to soften or outright end legal liabilities for employers who bring back their workforces amid the coronavirus pandemic. I understand the catch-22 for employers. I get it. there, we're not even sure exactly what kind of hermetically sealed situation you need to create in order to make sure people don't get it. My big fear is that if you soften or you end legal liability, then the obligation on the part of the employer yes. to protect their workers disappears. And I'm gonna tell, it's an interesting story for Paul Peter, who happens to also be an attorney. So Paul, when I remember going to England many years ago with my husband, my first husband, and we realized that, do you know when they started bringing in universal healthcare in England? They brought universal healthcare into England. And after they did that, it was only then that they got rid of sort of the tort liability for doctors. So first everybody had to be covered. And then they said, we're gonna sort of soften or get rid of tort liability for physicians. What Donald Trump wants to do, Val, and what I think Mitch McConnell wants to do, is he wants to make it really just an open door for employers and just say, don't worry about the liability issues. This is a risk we're all gonna take, but we're not gonna put any burden on you.
And you're right, and there's very little incentive for them to work for protections if liability is lessened. And that's the real danger of all of this. If you had very clear standards that every employer had to hold on to, but again, we don't know what those are, as you pointed out. But there's also another catch-22, and your article had pointed that out, Arnie, is that if workers refuse to go back to work, they're no longer eligible for unemployment.
Right.
And so I'm likening this back to the discussion about poor people who signed up for the military because they knew it was a steady income and it was the only outlet that they had. And we look at that now, and when we talk about the draft, and we see that it's not the middle class or the upper class that are supporting the military, it's people who are worried about having a paycheck. And here we're repeating that, and again, we're doing it with Central American immigrants who are the majority of the workers and people of color in the meatpacking plants, and if they don't go back to work, then they have nothing. And these are the most vulnerable people in the first place because they're working for barely above minimum wage. So it's this huge catch-22 where we're putting our most vulnerable in our society in harm's way.
So Paul Peter, how do we deal with this issue? Because I mean, I understand the idea of going back to work. I understand that you can't do everything, but if I am afraid of going back to work because I know there are no PPEs, because I know there aren't places to hand wash, because I know there isn't 6-foot distancing, how can anyone, I mean, how do you not sue about this? Because it's kind of like saying, walk in front of a gun and get shot. You know, it's perfectly fine. You did it with knowledge.
Right.
No, you didn't. You're being forced into a situation like this.
Let's look at this globally and ethically. What this basically is saying is that people, human beings, are expendable, period.
Yeah.
And once we lose them, there will be others to take their place. And it reminds me of what Albert Speer did with slave labor in the 1940s. Put them in there, they're expendable, and we're doing some level like that here. When we talk about safeguarding the workplace, yeah, there are ways to safeguard a workplace. There are things you could do, and that should be mandated. I don't see any requirements. I see companies that take the initiative to safeguard employees and doing what they can. But what are we doing about, you know, processing plants in Iowa? I don't hear any conversation about that. I hear no conversation about, as your other guests have noted, where are the conversations about safeguarding people, let alone a living wage? That's a separate issue, but they're not expendable. And we need to put it in that context. People are not expendable.
Well, I want to sort of circle back. And that is that once again, we know that the well-heeled, the probably mostly people of mostly white people and affluent people, they can shelter in place, they
yes.
can work at home, they can do everything from the confines of their house. They have the internet access they need, they have the degrees they need, they can still command high salaries, and they never have to leave the safety and security of their home. So now what we're doing is we already know there's a huge gap between rich and poor. We already know that there's a huge gap between who can work at home and who has to work in another setting at a low income. But now we're also saying to them that your lives have less value.
Well, you know, I think the reality you just sketched out is, you know, it's a fairly accurate one. You know, most of the, not most, but a lot of the folks who work from home are often in businesses or industries in which the movement has been towards increasing online presence for companies, corporations. It's a way to lower overhead rather than, you know, rather than fly all your business people around the country and pay for hotels and airfare, you can use these, you know, these virtual platforms. This has been a movement we've seen in a number of kind of high income, white collar jobs for a while now. So this has really just accelerated it. It hasn't had that much of an effect. It allows people to work at home with minimum disruption. But it is true that there for a whole sector of our economy, and a lot of these folks are now being referred to essential workers, even though they're not being paid like essential workers. They really have no option. I think a couple weeks ago, I mentioned some data that I saw that said something like only 1 in 5 African Americans can work at home, and only 1 in 6 Latinos can work at home. So they're dealing with a fundamentally different reality, a different pay structure, significantly greater disruption, significantly greater risk, because some of these folks live in, you know, kind of fairly small apartments, maybe multi-generational, as opposed to having a nice house where you have 2 or 3 people sheltering in place. So it increasingly feels like we're just not really sure what's going to happen over the next few months. I mean, it is very concerning to see these outbreaks at these processing plants, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. There are, I was thinking as I was listening to some of the other comments, there are some manufacturing interests, some businesses where kind of making a public display of all of the precautions you're taking is almost part of the marketing plan. Right, that increases the likelihood that upscale, well-heeled buyers will gravitate towards you if you can show you're taking care of your workforce. But that's not uniform across the manufacturing and industrial space. So there are some real dangers, I think, ahead of us as a society, and we're just going to kind of see this stuff happen as we go along. It's really, really quite concerning.
So Val, in Oklahoma, they had a mandatory face mask. You had to wear a face mask, the employees had to wear a face mask, and they had to actually walk it back because people went so crazy about being required to wear a face mask. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is can we ever set a standard in America, or do we have no sense of real community? Do we have no sense that there's sort of a bottom line threshold to protect all of us? I keep saying that the reason why I want to isolate in place is not only for me, but I want to protect the healthcare system. I want to protect the healthcare workers. But now I have to walk into an environment where some people are wearing masks, some people are not wearing masks, some people exhibit a standard, others don't exhibit a standard. What does that mean for this pandemic? Because we don't agree on anything, and there's nobody that is willing to insist on it.
Exactly. And we have been moving in that direction where we've emphasized as a society individual rights versus the rights of the community as a whole. And it's part of the reason why we're an increasingly litigious society, in that if I slip on the sidewalk in front of my neighbor's house, I'm much more likely to sue them because I don't even know my neighbor anymore. And because we don't gather as a community, and Robert Putnam wrote a wonderful book that was called Bowling Alone that really talks about this whole notion of the loss of the community. But what this has morphed into in a pandemic is that we are putting the most vulnerable in our community at risk without understanding that they are part of our community.
Well, let me just
say
something.
So this whole notion of separating and by income, and this is the consequence of income inequality. that we don't, again, we gather in neighborhoods of people of the same economic status with the same political attitudes. I don't know those immigrants who are working in the meatpacking plant. And so it becomes more difficult for me to be empathetic toward them. And so this is the consequence, like I said, is we're risking lives.
Well, let me just end here with Paul Peter. And Paul Peter, I think the problem is it also comes from the top. And with Donald Trump, the answer is you're on your own, Jack. So he keeps changing his position. He keeps supporting some governors, and he doesn't support some other governors. And he says it's really good people that are out there marching with their guns. What we get with Donald Trump is almost a license for basically people to sort of say, I'm not going to agree with any standard. So, I mean, if you had a president who was able to explain why we need to do this together, mm-hmm. who gave the concept of community, why this is about keeping your neighbors safe as well as everyone else. Instead, we've got a president who's role modeling exactly the kind of crazy behavior that we're seeing in response to this pandemic.
And as frustrated as I think we all are with the lack of leadership and integrity from the White House, ultimately, the voters have to take responsibility, because I don't understand how he gets a 49% approval rating for anything. I don't understand why or how he's going to get reelected, because there are things that he has done that are not Democratic, they're not Republican, they're not liberal, they're not conservative. The way he has handled this national crisis is not about partisanship, and it's not about ideology. It is about leadership. It is about unifying the nation, and he has divided our nation like never before, and voters have enabled it.
All right, so I'm gonna end here, but what I'm gonna say is what Donald Trump has played really well to is that he's played to resentment. And I don't think we understood how deep it was, how many people basically experienced it. I mean, remember, there's resentment since the economic meltdown. I mean, the resentment is everywhere. And then you're beginning to look at what's happening with manufacturing leaving and jobs leaving. And Donald Trump has played to that resentment. And on that note, we're going to end this segment of Rethink the Week. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about, oh, I think there's an election in November. Who's running? I think a guy named Joe Biden. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the day 4,000 auto workers at Chrysler's Dodge main plant in Hamtramck, Michigan, walked out in a wildcat strike. They protested assembly line speed up, but also racist foremen and the firings of 7 co-workers. The strike was significant for many reasons. It injected black power politics within the union movement. The CIO had made unprecedented gains in the 30s and 40s through interracial organizing and combating Jim Crow on the job. However, racial discrimination persisted in industries across America. The Wildcat shocked the UAW leadership, having prided itself in its early and central involvement in the civil rights movement. By 1968, many African Americans grew frustrated with the slow pace of reform and found the militancy of the Black Power movement attractive. According to historian Robert Weir, black auto worker activists considered many UAW officials paternalistic, condescending, and out of touch with the changing urban realities. Many of their white co-workers joined them on the picket lines. Black activists at Dodge, Maine, condemned the UAW for failing to address the disproportionate racial discrimination they faced on the job. They demanded a separate contract that spoke to the needs of black workers and the right to bargain directly with the company. The Wildcat immediately grew into the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement and inspired similar groupings at other area auto plants. Those white workers who were initially sympathetic worried that Drum's demands would serve to weaken and ultimately split the union movement along racial lines. Drum would continue to demand for safer working conditions, shorter hours, and higher wages, an end to the Vietnam War, and more black union officials and supervisors. The movement was short-lived, however, but continues to be revered among Detroit activists today. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Held it down, I believe. Turn the music loud,
I believe.
So no one could hear,
I believe her.
Put his hands on her,
I believe.
Covered up her mouth,
I believe.
But the truth is out,
I believe.
part deux of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Joining us for our Rethink the Week is Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, Paul Peter Jessup. He is an attorney and a former Republican, which I have to say over and over again, who actually worked for Susan Collins. And also joining us is Val Endres. Val Endres is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. So let me start with Val. We got to talk about Tara Reid. And the reason I start with you, unfortunately, is we're the two girls in this group. But the reason I do that is it suddenly occurred to me that the real problem for Joe Biden is that right now, Joe Biden has been having a really difficult time punching out, getting exposure, have people paying attention to him. We knew that during the presidential primary. But now it's gotten worse that he's in his basement and we have a pandemic. All right. So now he's in his basement in a pandemic. And the story that is resonating virtually everywhere is the story of Tara Reid. What does he do, Val? What does he do? Because he's got to get beyond this. Otherwise, this will be way too defining.
Well, we started with a person who was a weak campaigner to begin with, and we knew that from the very beginning. And for those people who observed in the New Hampshire primary, he was by far the weakest candidate, both rhetorically and catching up to the ideas of others. You know, and we also saw that in the debates when he was angered by the other candidates. He almost resented the fact that they were on stage with him. He's not very good at social media. And now to pile on, we have the inevitable scandal. And I think for a lot of women, this is supremely disappointing. And there's a real irony here, I think, that women have been called upon to defend him, and several leaders have, in Nancy Pelosi and Stacey Abrams and Kristen Gillibrand for beginning. But it's also looking at the talent that's left behind. And we had very qualified women in this run. And everybody was told that we needed to coalesce around a safe candidate. And suddenly, that candidate is no longer safe. So I think there's going to be a lot of resentment there about this. And we have not come to grips with how we deal with sexual harassment, both in the corporate arena and in the political arena. I think we're better at it in the corporate arena than we are in the political arena. And Anita Hill has talked about this in the past, and she's talking about it now, is that we have no process in place, no infrastructure in place to investigate these claims. And we have a Senate committee, and the closest we came was with Brett Kavanaugh, and it did no good. But we have to come to grips with this, and particularly when those allegations happen 10, 20, 30 years in the past. And we can't blame the women. And one could look at this and say, why didn't she speak up before now? It's most inopportune that she did not, if the allegations are true. But again, we're focusing in on the alleged victim rather than the perpetrator. And to compound these problems, Joe Biden waited far too long to even respond to this,
yes, exactly.
Which again sends the message that this isn't important enough for him. And he has to be backed into a corner. And after women leaders and female leaders have defended him before he deigns to even address the issue. This is where we are right now with our so-called safe candidate.
So, Paul Peter, as I'm listening to this, you know what? This kind of reminds me of everyone saying, it's been so long. Why did she wait? Her story keeps changing, all these things. There's this gap, whatever. And then I go back to what happened with the Catholic Church and how long it took so many people sort of to talk about this. And they weren't perfect people. You know, that just because someone abused you, the assumption is the abuser is imperfect and you must be perfect. Well, they're not.
That's right, Arnie.
And I think that's part of the problem for this woman is that she's got a lot of problems in her story. But no one is asking for a perfect story. And yet at the same time, I also want to blame a little bit about the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement also had Donald Trump as their counterpoint. And they came out with the idea of believe all women. And I'm not sure that was the right statement to make, Paul Peter. I think you need to hear all women and that we have a right to be heard. I know I've lied. I know women that have lied. So the idea of believing isn't the answer, but the idea is for the longest time, we haven't even heard them.
I would completely agree with that. I think anyone who comes forward and makes an allegation of harassment, sexual assault, whether it be a man or a woman, because it also does happen to men, they have to be listened to. However, we do need to make sure that just because someone has an accusation, we don't condemn that person automatically. We take the allegation seriously. And before the program started, Arnie, we were talking about there should be a vetting committee that examines this and who should be on the committee to explore what's in the Biden archives. And this needs to get done well before the Democratic convention. And if there's something there, then have an open convention and find another candidate, period.
So Dean, again, I think the Democratic Party is so committed to removing Donald Trump. They wanted this to happen. They were so excited that, you know, Joe Biden was talking about getting a woman VP. He was so talking about maybe getting even a woman of color VP. And now I feel like women are bearing all the burden of explaining this away, of trying to figure out how to do this. And Joe hasn't been helpful, number one. As Val mentioned, he waited so long. And frankly, he's never really explained Hunter Biden. Now we've got this. I feel like this is kind of like, not that he's even close to Donald Trump, but some of the veins of unhappiness with Donald Trump have to do with, you know, impropriety and business relationships and women. And now I've got Joe Biden with impropriety and with business relationships and women. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to be here, especially now, Dean.
Yeah, you know, this isn't the, when we think back a little while, this isn't the first time that Democrats and particularly Democratic women have been in a very difficult position. You know, remember back to Bill Clinton when there were, you know, many more accusations and a lot more smoke. We had the same discussion about women being put in the position of having to defend his behavior as he ran for election and then for re-election in 96. So this feels a little bit like that again, although, as I said, with Clinton, there were multiple accusations and a lot more smoke. But nonetheless, you know, Biden, we've talked many times about, you know, whether we're talking about Hunter Biden or this accusation, the kind of the tendency, and he's not the first campaign that you see this with, to kind of not realize that they need to get out ahead of a story and wait a little bit while. You know, the reality is that he's in a tough position because this is just not going to go away. I've already, my sampling of kind of the Twitterverse, which is mainly where this conversation is being had right now, although it did spill over onto the weekend cable shows. It has the same partisan overlays that we have with everything else in this country, whether we're talking about lifting the quarantine or anything else. You know, Republicans and people who don't like the Democrats are, you know, saying that this needs to be investigated and this looks like it's really bad for Biden, and Democrats are trying to defend him. I will say just one practical matter, as someone who has spent a lot of hours, in fact, weeks in presidential archives around the country doing research on archives, I hear a lot of journalists say, oh, we just need to look at the Delaware archives. Well, my understanding is there are something like 1,800 to 2,000 boxes in that archive. And I can tell you that archivists talk about presidential and vice presidential papers in terms of linear feet, not in terms of easily. They spend years digitizing stuff. And so when I hear journalists say, well, they just need to give us access to the archives, it's not practical. Some of it may be digitized and you know, I heard one journalist say, well, they just need to run a search on her name. Well, if this happened 25, 27 years ago,
exactly, they can't.
That stuff's not going to be, it's going to be a box with a lot of junk stacked in it, and someone would have to go through it manually. So it's doable, but it's not doable in a weekend or even a month.
And you still have to go through the classification process because exactly. he was the vice president. Yeah. And so that is going to delay it for a very long time.
Yeah.
And the archives are everybody's behind on those things.
Yeah,
so
and I will say
it's not practical.
One other practical matter as well is, you know, people talk about, well, he should just open up his files. Standard, you know, for oral histories and for classified material, it's standard operating procedure that for many of these politicians, the stuff's not even available until after they die. I mean, that because of the frankness of what's in a lot of these files. So I'm not sort of saying that we should drop this issue, but there are real practical issues with doing this in a fair, careful way before November.
Okay, so one of the things I had suggested before we began this conversation on air was that I thought that Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and Val Demings and Katie Porter should be the four people to go into those files. You're absolutely right. You don't want them to look everywhere. You want them to be focused on this issue. First of all, let's also remember, they're not gonna have to go through 40 years of boxes. They're only gonna have to go through maybe 2 or 3 years of that time frame to look. So that at least if nothing else, you've narrowed it down. And you're looking for one.
Perhaps.
I mean, yeah. I don't think it'll go into 1996.
No, I understand what you're saying.
Right. So, but at some point in time, in order to attain closure, I don't know what else you do because it is a he say, she said.
Yeah.
And that just by its definition is problematic. And we look at Donald Trump as what we're trying to respond to. And unfortunately, Donald Trump is going to be able to use this very effectively.
But Arnie, there's another solution, and you had suggested, for example, for the good of the party, that Bernie not run this year, and which was a fairly compelling argument. And one could maybe think about the fact that leaders of the Democratic Party could convince Biden that he ought not to continue his run. If there was enough pressure there, then that's also a possibility.
I agree with Val completely, and I think one of the challenges for the Democratic Party is it has failed to groom talented people up the ladder. They have failed to bring in new blood. I mean, Kamala Harris was a wonderful candidate. Cory Booker Gillibrand is a very talented senator from New York. And for whatever reason, we go with status quo rather than saying the old guard needs to move on, they need to let go. And as much as you can say that Hillary Clinton was more than qualified to be president of the United States, I will never, ever forget Ted Kennedy standing on a podium with his niece saying, it's time to pass the torch. And he endorsed U.S. Senator Barack Obama. 8 years later, nothing is done to bring in new blood into the Democratic Party to mentor new leadership, particularly women. What do? They send it back to Hillary.
Could I just follow up on that? Because I really think that that's a very, very important point to address. It's not going to change necessarily what happens in November. But one amendment I would make to Paul's argument is that there actually were a whole lot of qualified Democratic candidates this time around.
Yes.
It wasn't like nobody was available, and so Joe had to take the nomination. But I want to know from people like Dean, you and I respect you very much, but you and I talked many, many times during 2019 about Joe Biden and, you know, all of the reasons we didn't know about Tara Reid then, but we knew about Clarence Thomas and we knew about Anita Hill and we knew about Democratic senators.
But to be fair, my argument with you was always that not that he should be president, but that he would be the nominee. So just to be clear on that, I was never I'm agnostic about that as a political scientist. My argument with you was simply reading the way the situation was developing, even though he was way down in the polls, I continued to believe that he would end up being the nominee.
That's what I think we need to address, though, is why nobody was, or hardly anybody was saying,
And the idea that I'm
as opposed to what Arnie said about Bernie is that you just shouldn't run.
And the idea that I'm seeing on Twitter now that we're going to stop everything and substitute in Bernie I know you're not saying that, Arnie, but that's what a lot of the Bernie crowd is now arguing, that, well, you know, Joe can step aside and Bernie's ready to go.
Well, Val, you heard the interview.
Oh, it's Elizabeth.
We did an interview with Bill.
That's true too.
We did an interview with Bill Curry on Friday, and I know you listened to it, Val. And what did Bill say? And Bill said, message to progressives, it ain't going to be Bernie and it ain't going to be Elizabeth.
Right.
I mean, that was exactly what he said. And I think actually, in order to create that stability, it shouldn't be Elizabeth and it shouldn't be Bernie, to be honest with you. I mean, whatever the decision that was made, the decision was more made in kind of the Biden camp, whatever that is. But I think that Biden right now, he was flawed when Jim Clyburn stepped up to sort of create him. We now have new flaws going into this. And I am not saying that because I am a progressive or because I'm a liberal. I'm just saying it because he's not a strong candidate. And now with
the
baggage, it's becoming...
I also think that your guest, Bill Curry, had suggested that there are some people, and I think you suggested it as well, who can talk to Biden. Obama is one of them. Yeah. And the party leaders need to step up. Now is the time. And if the Democrats want to lead and they want to defeat Donald Trump, here is their opportunity.
And the idea, Paul Peter, that we're not being hypocrites. I mean, that's what we're hearing that over and over again. Look at the standard you set for Blasey Ford. Look at the standard that's now being set for Tara Reid. How do you explain that? Look at the standard that you set for Donald Trump when it comes to impropriety, and look at the standard that you set for Hunter Biden. We're constantly having to sort of explain something. When we need to sprint into the future, when we need to deal with a pandemic, when we need to deal with an economy that's crashing around us, when we need to deal with relationships, the new thing that Donald Trump wants to do, well, it's not new, he wants to blame China. I mean, so China now is going to be the fault of everything, the fault for our economy, the fault for our pandemic. And you know what? A lot of people don't like China anyway because they saw their jobs going to China. It will resonate. And what will be our counterargument?
Here's a silver lining in the cloud. It's not too late to find another nominee other than Biden. However, there needs to be leadership within the hierarchy of the Democratic Party that says we need an open convention if Joe doesn't want to step down, or force Joe to step down and find the right candidate. There's still time to do that.
Dean, can you imagine the Democratic Party ever doing that? I mean, I mean,
no.
Exactly.
With all due respect, that's not going to happen.
Exactly.
That would be the end of the election for the Democrats if they did that. There's no way the Democrats could win if they, in August, have an open convention and replace the nominee.
The nominee.
So what could they do, Dean? What could they do now?
It depends on the nominee, number one, and if Tara Reid does not, if this story does not go away, and if it has legs, if there is some clear corroboration, this is over.
Yeah, and well, I would agree with you.
But this is where Biden could step in and be for the good of the country, and he doesn't have to admit guilt. He can just say, for the good of the country,
exactly.
I'm stepping aside.
Absolutely. And right now, Donald Trump has a 50-50 chance of winning.
Right.
No question.
Right. I guess,
let me just say one thing. I was sort of halfway through it. All I will say on that point is, there may come a point at which I would agree that Biden is mortally wounded. All I'll say is that we're not there yet, particularly given all of the sort of counterbalancing aspects of this with Trump and the, you know, two dozen women who have accused him as well. So yes, this is problematic, but I don't think we're at a point yet where we need to talk about, or the Democratic Party needs to talk about replacing him. We may get to that point. I don't think we're there yet with this. That's just my opinion.
Oh, okay. So I've got two professors here, and I don't want to lose the opportunity to talk to you as professors at academic institutions. What happens in the fall? We have young people. I mean, this is about, so we have young people who are thinking about how do you deal with a public school education, given the fact that we're doing social distancing, how do you put them on buses? But I want to talk to the two of you, Dean and Val, about what do we do where we're talking about tuition. All right, this is not free. This is not public school. This is higher ed. Higher ed ain't cheap. If you're going to do an online course, then you're not going to pay what you paid if it was going to be an in-class opportunity. How are colleges looking at this going forward? Are they going to open and say, we're going to just assume it's going to be a roller coaster, and maybe part of the time it's going to be online, and then part of the time it's going to be within an academic institution, that there is no sort of real plan in place because we have no clue?
Yeah, it's a big question. I think it varies from school to school based on, you know, number of students involved. You know, some universities you're talking 30, 40,000 students. Some liberal arts colleges you're talking maybe, you know, 2,000 students or 2,500 students. And the schools have differing kind of financial cushions and differing levels of transition in terms of technology. So, I think most schools sort of, all things being equal, I think schools for a variety of reasons want to get the students back on campus. You know, tuition and room and board is central to a lot of these schools financially. They're also taking a huge hit in their endowments. And the communities around these schools that basically thrive on students spending money in the towns are all taking a hit. You know, there are various kind of mitigation measures they may take in terms of reducing density in dorms by having some kids the option of staying online and others being in residence. Reducing class size, using larger halls and spreading people out. I'm hearing virtually every conceivable option under the sun being discussed. The reality is nobody knows what's going to happen for sure. We'll have a better idea, I think, probably by mid-June.
So let me just say something, and that is I keep going back to Bernie and Elizabeth Warren about free higher education. And all of a sudden, I think in a lot of ways, Val, some of this would be easier if you knew that you didn't have to fork up $15,000, $25,000, $30,000, that you would be able to sort of exercise a choice that wouldn't also burden you with debt. I mean, you've got Betsy DeVos going after 300,000 students for, you know, not being able to pay back their loans when they don't even have a job. And I think in an interesting way, the conversation about universal healthcare and the conversation about free hire, all of a sudden now, we're having a come to Jesus conversation because guess what? You might need those two.
And it takes away the financial issues that the colleges or the universities will feel, at least the public ones. And the other thing that I want to point out, and that is the graying of the professorate. And at Rhode Island College, for example, the majority of our professors are 60 years old and older.
Oh, wow.
And that is not all that unusual, particularly since academic positions have been drying up. Professors have been teaching longer than they used to. And so we have that risk to begin with. And I think many professors look at this and try to play it out in their head. And one of the problems is, how do you deal with social distancing in the classroom? And Andrew Cuomo had talked about the fact that you can't put any more than 8 people in a subway car with proper social distancing. So play that out in K through 12, where we have overcrowded classrooms, and also in the college where you have much lecturing, and how do you even get the people into the classroom in social distancing? How do they leave with social distancing? What do you do if somebody contracts COVID-19 and you have 14 days of quarantining with the class? And so there are all of these considerations if we're to follow the recommendations now that I don't see how they play out.
All right, so Paul Peter, I want to end with you. And that is that, so we were talking a little bit about higher ed, but let's talk about public education. Public education isn't just about educating kids. It's about allowing parents to go back to work. Because if you don't have public schools open, and we clearly know we've never had enough in when it comes in the way of daycare, this is a real challenge for opening up the economy. This isn't just about school. This is about the economy. Why did, in the state of New Hampshire, did we so desperately want mandatory kindergarten? Why was the business community jumping all over the place about mandatory kindergarten? Because they wanted their people to know that they could go to work and they wouldn't have to worry about the cost of daycare for their five-year-old because they'd be in full-day kindergarten. I mean, so that's the other problem with school. It isn't just about the academics, Paul Peter.
And let's not forget about children who rely on lunches every day. In some places, children rely on breakfast every day. Sometimes that will be two very important meals that they would not otherwise get. And are they getting them now? So that's a whole another factor here in terms of, and Val is absolutely right. The logistics of this have not been thought through. There is no long-term planning. There is no practicality to any of this. Yeah. Here in New York, we have ended the school year, but it will supposedly start up again in September. But there will not be social distancing. And if let's expand that whole idea of social distancing. Broadway's not going to open up. Lincoln Center's not going to open up.
Right.
No one has given any thought.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to let all of you go. I think what is so amazing about this pandemic is that it touches every aspect of every single thing we do. There is no roadmap. There is no roadmap. It is a time of interesting chaos, you know, and, you know, we know what Donald Trump wants, which is an open economy, but you and I both now know we don't even define what an open economy looks like anymore. Anyway, Paul Peter Jessup, Dean Spiliotis, Val Endres, and Ken Barnes, thank you so much. This is the end of Rethink the Week, the Monday edition of The Attitude. See you tomorrow.
People try to put us down. Talking about my generation. Don't you all fade away.
Talking about my generation.
Don't try to dig what we all say.
Talking about my generation.
I'm trying to cause a big sensation.
Talking about my generation.
Talking about my generation.
Talking about my generation.
My generation. My generation, baby. My generation. Don't you all fade away. Don't try to dig what we all say.
Talking about my generation.
I'm not trying to cause a big sensation.
Talking about my generation.
Talking about my generation.
Talking about my generation.
My generation. My generation, baby. To
talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things ain't too awful.